В моем ближайшем окружении нет чиновников.
Путин и в окружении их создали.
И если президент не сменит ту команду, которая его окружает.
Путин прореживает ближайшее окружение.
Люди украли, и вокруг Путина собрались жулики и воры.
Вокруг Владимира Владимировича находятся верные соратники.
Я ни с кем не сближаюсь и не собираюсь сближаться.
The Putin is getting smaller. Not the man, of course. Vladimir Putin's still the same size, give or take a few kilos here or there. But the collective Putin, that deep inner sanctum of decision-making that once comprised dozens of people representing various elite interests, has clearly been downsized to a handful of close and like-minded associates. The fat cat oligarchs, the bean-counting finance experts, and the pragmatic technocrats are out. The hardline Siloviki and the ideologues are in, with no check on their ambitions. This marks a sharp departure from the way Russia has been governed for the past decade, which has been based on a broad elite consensus. The result of this change is clearly visible in the Kremlin's Ukraine policy, which has taken an aggressive turn in recent weeks, despite an ailing economy reeling from falling oil prices and Western sanctions. But its implications are much more wide-reaching than the current conflict. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
Hey, and it's just me and you today, so let's get to it. I've characterized that we were conversing off mic over the week, and I characterized what we're witnessing in the ruling circle, in Putin's ruling circle, the collective Putin, the Politburo, the deep state. I characterize it as the withering of Russia's deep state and the emergence of a small ruling cabal. Would you agree with that characterization, and what are the implications?
Yeah, it's quite interesting that... I mean, if we think of the characteristics of the old deep state, it had really sort of two crucial ones. One was precisely that it was deep, in the sense of we knew that there were substructures of power that actually dominated the formal visible structures. But exactly quite how it worked and the fact that it was there was kept on the down low. And the second point was that it was a broad deep state. That actually it embraced to different levels a whole range of elements of the elite. And what we're seeing is actually both of these are falling apart. On the one hand, shall we say, the state is less deep but more secretive. Whereas once upon a time, again, if we sort of envisaged it as some sort of Atlantis lying beneath the waves, now it is a sort of small secretive desert island or a sort of Bond villain's palace. That everyone knows is there. No one knows actually quite what goes on within it, because we certainly know that the deliberations of this small cabal are indeed exceedingly well shrouded. But the point is, there's much less pretense. And the second point is precisely, it's so much smaller. And again, I think that is absolutely crucial, because
we're talking about a handful of people now.
Yeah, and it's not even just, I mean, it was always a handful of people who made the decisions. But there was a larger, much, much larger body of people who at least had some traction on the process.
But there was
at least felt they were talked to.
There was like a dozen or so people. Now it's down to just, I mean, the names that keep popping up are what? Patrushev, Ivanov, some people put Shoigu in there. It's a very, very small group. In fact, Fred Weir wrote this week that there's actually two entrances to Putin's office, and you can't see who's coming in or going out, so it even keeps secret who's even getting into the deepest part of the inner sanctum. But yeah, continue with your thought.
I think it's not just about how many people are in the real core central decision-making process element, which, yes, clearly has shrunk. It's the extent to which these people are still connected by the connective tissue, the musculature of, I suppose not, advising isn't quite the right word, but that sense that other institutions, other people did at least have some scope for impact on the system. That even if, for example, Kudrin was not a decision maker, once upon a time, Kudrin at least got to actually express his own views, even to the point of the general staff. it seems that they're much, much less in a position to actually express their own views. So I think this is what's happened. It's not just, I mean, there's been a double shrinkage. A shrinkage in terms of the core people who make the decisions, and also a much larger shrinkage of the people who actually at least have some degree of input into that decision-making process.
Right. Yeah, and I wanted to, in terms of the implications of this, there was a recent commentary that Vyedomosti's editor-in-chief, Maxim Trudolubov, wrote this week, in which he called, it was published in Russian in Vyedomosti and in English in the Moscow Times. He called the regime in Russia, quote, a true work of art, but one that only looks good from a single vantage point, the point of its creator. He goes on to say, quote, why would any government create conditions that make existence impossible for business people, scientists, artists, and everyone else in whom the country would ordinarily take pride? And why, at the same time, create conditions that enable scoundrels and crooks to prosper? Why punish the best members of society and encourage the worst? Trudolubov goes on to cite the American political scientist Bruce Bueno de Mesquita, the author, of course, of The Dictator's Handbook. And de Mesquita argues that authoritarian rulers can remain in power for a long time by relying on a small, manageable number of chosen associates and controlling the country's resources. This seems to be where we are now with Putin, no?
Well, I think, first of all, it's necessary to strip away slightly. I think there is an element of the Moscow metropolitan middle class hyperbole coming in there. In that, I think at the moment we're not talking about a country in which it's, you know, everyone is miserable and no one can find it possible right to operate. But we're certainly heading in that direction. Again, it's part of this sort of creeping, in effect, Sovietization of Russian life. I think the second point I'd raise, and I think it was a good and interesting article, and I have to excuse, I'm croaking because of my cold.
Yeah, I got a cold too.
is that I'm not so sure that this should be considered Putin's work of art, in the sense of I'm not so sure that this is actually where Putin wanted to be. I think it's more actually that this is what Putin is finding himself increasingly pushed into because of two things. One is life, that, you know, in the Harold Macmillan, you know, It's Events, Dear Boy, that actually sort of having been so used to being master of his universe, he's now finding that actually the world is proving to be a more complex place. And this is the second point. Instead of confronting that complexity, I think he's trying to ignore it by precisely shrinking his field of vision, shrinking his earshot to only voices and sounds and pictures that seem to fit and make his world nicely, simply comprehensible. I don't want to make him sound like a moron. I think he just made that decision that so many autocrats do make of only really wanting to hear things that suit him. So in some ways, I think it's actually that in many ways, I think Putin's ideal was precisely the deep state, the Putin terms one and two political model. However, faced now with a series of ideological, geopolitical, practical complexities, Putin is, I think, forced into increasingly oversimplifying his political system. And therefore, I mean, I think that we should realize that this is not as if this is where he was. This is not, I think, the end of a trajectory. Putin has not been building to this position. Mm-hmm. I think Putin is just finding himself when he's having to make hard choices, the choices he's making are defaulting him into this position.
And it's interesting, we keep going back to this, but that decision back in September 2011, the castling, of course, it looms ever larger because if you're right, and I think you are, that he did want to keep this kind of deep state ruling the way it had been during his first two terms, but the castling blew that up, and he could have kept it going if he just stepped out of formal power and continued to rule de facto. The Deng Xiaoping variant. He could have done it, and he wouldn't be in this place, in the place that he is now, domestically at least. What about the efficiency of decision making in a deep state, as we had during Putin 1 and 2, and in a ruling cabal, which we essentially have now? How would you characterize the efficiency there? Is this inherently a less efficient model?
I think it's inherently prone to be a less efficient model. As an essentially arrogant soul who's sure the world would be a better place if he was running it, I can't necessarily say that having only a small number of people necessarily automatically makes for bad decision making. It can actually make for things that are efficient, both in terms of the speed in which policy is made.
Certainly with this current
But also, if the individuals concerned are both smart and lucky, they can make good policy. But it tends towards much worse decision making for several reasons. One is that there are fewer inputs. You're unlikely in a smaller set, and we certainly see this around Putin, to have the right spread of information. You know, it's something that we've raised in previous podcasts, but you know, there is no one in Putin's inner circle who understands economics. And that is patently, embarrassingly, awkwardly, dangerously visible in policy at the moment. So I think
visible today as the central bank lowered interest rates from 17 to 15. I mean, if you're going to lower interest rates, that's kind of a strange numbers to go from. But then the ruble immediately went down again. It was when I went to the studio, it was below 70.
Exactly. I mean, this is it. I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing flailing around rather than any clear strategy on economics. But so it's not just it's first of all, is that inner circle is more likely to actually lack certain skills. Secondly, the very speed which it can be a virtue is also a vice, in that it means it's more likely to actually make precipitate decisions that it can then repent at leisure. And very much we see that with eastern Ukraine. The Crimea is an example of how it can work well, in the sense of precisely they were able to move fast with no information leakage and catch everyone by surprise. But Crimea was, you know, such an outlier. It was such a perfect opportunity. One would have been hard-pressed to come up with a better one, something that was because I'd be such a crowd-pleaser and so easy to do. So in some ways, I think the trouble is that actually seems to have emboldened them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas actually a much better example of the kind of problem that arises is eastern Ukraine, where precisely what seems to have been a simple decision actually turns out to get them in an immensely and monstrously complex situation. And it's in part a complex situation because it is patently clear that when they were making the decisions in, I was going to say the Kremlin, but I don't much doubt it was the Kremlin in Putin's dacha, they didn't understand the full complexities of Ukrainian politics. They thought they had a really straightforward operation that would lead to a real, really, really straightforward capitulation, and they didn't realize that Kiev could not or would not do that. And that's why they're stuck.
So there's a tendency towards groupthink, I guess, is what we could say.
Groupthink, a lack of checks and balances, and a lack of a broad range of inputs into policy.
And tending to push towards the more extreme solutions. I mean, you have not just a smaller deep state, but you have a very like-minded deep state. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the technocrats, the economic specialists, they're out, and these are the people that cared about what the West thinks, right? I don't want to say just the Siloviki broadly, but the hardliners of the Siloviki, the imperialists, the ideologues are in, and they're reinforcing this notion that Putin can successfully challenge the Western system right now and get away with it and win. They're telling him he could destroy NATO, I think. I mean, I think they really are. I wanted to. Another piece I read this week, I talked about it on the Daily Vertical very briefly this morning and quoted it as a piece by the American scholar Walter Russell Mead writing in The American Interests. He's basically saying that the West is kind of deluded about Putin and deluded about his intentions and deluded about where he wants to take this. He said, quote, from a Western point of view, Putin has been so weakened by the oil crash and the Western sanctions that the only thing that remains is to negotiate his surrender. But he adds, what the West doesn't understand about Putin is that he doesn't think the West is as strong as the West thinks it is. Putin thinks the West has fallen in love with its own prejudices and illusions, and that the imposing structures of the Western world, both NATO and the UN in particular, are hollow facades. And he concludes that Putin seems to believe that the false foundations underneath the imposing facade of the West continue to erode at an accelerating pace, and it does not take a strong push to knock over a house of cards. Putin still thinks he can win. He is certainly acting that way. Putin wouldn't be thinking and acting that way if he had his old deep state and all the inputs of it there, I don't think, right? I mean, is this, and assuming Mead's characterization of Putin is correct, and I do think it's correct, to be honest, but we would be seeing a different kind of behavior with a different set of inputs that you'd get from a broader deep state than you're getting from this narrow cabal, no?
We would. I mean, I think I'd want to just stop for a moment and dwell on it. actually sort of, I think it was a good piece by Mead. I think that I would want to raise a couple of cautions about it first, though. First of all, we really have to be very careful at the moment. And although, obviously, we do it all the time, but we have to acknowledge that when we say Putin thinks, mm-hmm. one of the crucial problems we have these days is none of us know. And when I say none of us, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter if you're in the CIA or wherever, or indeed most senior Russian officials don't really know what Putin thinks. That's, I think, a crucial issue we have, is that he has retreated so far into his black box that we're just having to guess. And again, if I can mix my metaphors, instead of a black box, he's a Rorschach ink blot that we just describe what we expect to see.
Although we could extrapolate from his behavior a bit, no?
To an extent, but I think the thing is then, we have two issues here. What's his game plan? And I think it is clear that it is this notion of sovereignty. And to this extent, he is indeed a victim of his own ideology and his own rhetoric. For so long, there's been this talk about Russian sovereignty, which is seen not just simply as an internal and domestic factor, but also that Russia must be externally independent from the understandings and the rules of international behavior. So much so that I think he has come to believe that he genuinely can pull it off. The business about thinking that the West is weak, I'm not sure that he necessarily thinks that indeed the West is about to collapse economically or whatever, or is crucially undermined by the falling oil prices or anything like that. What I do believe is that he believes that the West is weak in the one most intangible, but probably for him most important characteristic, which is will. There
That's
is
this asymmetrical advantage.
Yeah, there is this distinctly Bolshevik element to Putin, this sense that, in fact, if you have a sufficient focus and drive, then, in a way, there is nothing that cannot be achieved. And I think that's where he's not dumb enough to not be able to look at the tallies of economic strength, the tallies of military strength, but he absolutely is sure that the West, when it comes down to it, is too weak to take advantage of those objective strengths. And this is the problem, because how does anyone argue against that? How does anyone prove that he's wrong until it actually happens, as we see now with the whole sanctions regime, that it is demonstrated through disastrous impacts on Russia?
Yeah, no, one of my colleagues asked me, I raised the question on the Daily Vertical today, is Putin playing a weak hand very well right now, or is he dangerously overplaying his hand? And he said, why didn't you answer that question? I said, well, because I don't know. Really, because where I and this comes down to the question of will on the part of the West. I don't know, because I'm not really quite sure how the West is going to handle this. That's what's going to determine whether or not he's overplaying his hand or not.
The point is, his hand. I mean, again, if we want to use this metaphor, which actually I think works very well. The point about that is we know that he has a weak hand. Well, you and I know that his hand isn't going to be that strong in objective terms. But there is clearly sufficient doubt he's bluffing very well. He's obviously at the moment playing a weak hand exceedingly well. The point is, until actually the game is over, one can't actually reach some kind of a judgment as to whether or not he's a good game player or whether he's precisely dangerously overexposing himself. So this is why there is no way you could have given an answer to that question, because the answer is both or neither. We're in a whole Schrodinger's cat situation there.
Yeah. And another thing I actually raised this today as well is the old Putin coming back? Because there seems to be this wish in the West that if you apply enough pressure, then that old Putin, who was, let's face it, was troublesome and a bit of a pain in the ass, but he wasn't this Putin. We could do business with him. He would play ball with us to a degree, right? That if you apply enough pressure economically, enough sanctions, the right sanctions, eventually that Putin's going to come back. I think that Putin's gone. Mm-hmm. Partially because something has changed in him, as much as we can see, but also partially because the people he's surrounding himself with are completely different, no?
I sincerely hope that the West is not hoping that they can put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Because it's absolutely the case. They cannot bring back the old Putin. They can certainly, in theory at least, create a different Putin's Russia. one that is less dangerous, less problematic for Western interests. But yeah, first of all, Putin himself has changed. Yeah. Putin, in his first two terms, genuinely felt that there was, although he was no great fan of NATO in the West, that there actually was scope for mutually positive partnership, admittedly on his own terms. And secondly, that in some ways Russia's interests lay with partnership with the West. Mm. Increasingly, it's clear that he actually sees the West as being corrosive and toxic to what's important about Russia, which is its sort of culture and its identity and its autonomy. And therefore, even if he is forced into backing away, even if he is forced by, whether it's economic shock or whatever, into adopting a more conciliatory policy, it will be between gritted teeth. This will not be a partner in any meaningful sense at all, ever.
Hmm. One of the things I've noticed lately is that a lot of plans that have been on the books in the filing cabinet for a while, be they the incursion into Ukraine, which, let's face it, the Kremlin think tank RISI had been advocating for a long time, or the ties that came to light this week between Russia and the new leftist government in Greece. These things had been on the books. These things had been in the filing cabinet. And suddenly now these things are being put into action. My colleague Robert Coulson did an excellent piece this week on the ties between Dugin and the new ruling party in Greece, and how these kinds of things, this had been cultivated for a long time. And these things are not just being cultivated in Greece, they're being cultivated all over Europe. Russia's hoping to get either extreme left or extreme right parties that are going to be more pro-Moscow into power. And they're working on this, but now they're working on it actively. They're putting this into action, just like over the past year, they put the Ukraine plan that was probably on the books for a long time into action. Is this a function of just opportunity, or is it a function of the fact that Putin is really now surrounded by people who had been advocating these kinds of things all along?
I think that it's more than anything else a function of opportunity. And shall we say natural bias rather than plan. It's just as with old sort of Comintern days, it was easy to see the rise of leftist movements in Europe and the world as being down to Moscow. And clearly Moscow was thoroughly supportive. But in fact, more than anything else, it tended to represent internal tensions and divisions within the countries in question. Well, likewise, if we look at the modern Putin turn, yes, of course, Russia is actively going to support anti-union, anti-NATO, anti-American organizations in Greece, in Spain, wherever they can find them. And of course, this fits in with the natural bias of Putin and the people around him these days. And of course, it's part of Russia's national interests. Mm-hmm. But to suggest that there's some kind of grand plan, I think, is much more problematic. It's exactly the same as if we look at, for example, obviously the West is going to support pro-democracy, pro-transparency movements in Russia and elsewhere in Eurasia, because that's the kind of Eurasia we want to see. But unfortunately, or fortunately, the notion that that's part of some grand plan for color revolutions is, of course, not really the case. I think it's the same way this way. I mean, the Kremlin has a bias. Yes, of course, the Kremlin now is going to be especially assiduous in cultivating those organizations. Mm. I don't think it's some kind of long plan. I think we're very much seeing stuff which has been thrown together, has been thrown together since Putin returned to office with his new nationalist turn of mind. Mm. Now, it might be that what we're seeing is the beginnings of a strategy. I think that's where it fits in. I think now we're beginning to see, whereas, in, as it were, Putin, his first year or two in office, he was, I think, buffeted by events. He was much more concerned or almost shocked by what had happened domestically with Bolotnaya. And we got very, I mean, this is something we were talking about at the podcast at the time, that sense of, well, what's happening? Where's it going? There doesn't seem to be any movement. So I think it's only now that we're really beginning to see that movement emerge. And if Putin and this regime survives, and I don't just simply mean, you know, in terms of Putin falling, but if it manages to maintain its current autonomy of operation, in a couple of years' time, we'll definitely be able to look back and say, ah, yes, that strategy that was perhaps begun in 2014 is now clearly being fleshed out. But as I said, I think at the moment we're seeing ad hoc measures that are beginning to coalesce into strategy.
Do you, this Putin turn, I mean, does this, how much does this concern you? I mean, because I wrote about this, I checked back today. The first time I wrote about this was December 2013. I did a blog post on this where Putin wants to be the leader of the world's conservatives, and he's creating, you know, the conservative international, so to speak. And it was, at the time, it was kind of like, ha, ha, ha. Well, here we are in January 2015, and lo and behold, one of these has come to power in Greece. It's a left-wing party, but it's basically, it's a cultivation of the extreme left and the extreme right, and it's in a coalition government with an extreme right party that is pro-Moscow. Do you expect we're going to see a repetition of this? I mean, is this a danger, or is this a one-off, what we're seeing in Greece?
Yeah, I'd have to challenge, I think, the characterization that these are necessarily pro-Moscow. Look, Putin is not going to find himself in charge of a bunch of proxy parties all across the world. Not at all. And I don't think he wants to. He does not care what happens in Greece. He doesn't care what happens in Spain, except insofar as it actually is a way of splitting and dividing the West and its alliance and its unity. And again, we go back to its will. So I think it's not so much that he's looking for pro-Moscow parties as anti-everything else. Mm-hmm. I think this is the thing. I mean, does it concern me? Yes, very much so. It concerns me because you will have what, I was going to use the word actively mischievous, but that makes it sound quite sweet and short-trousered and so forth. Malign attempt to precisely foment division and disunity. And that absolutely is going to be a challenge. And we're already seeing it. We're seeing it in the Baltic states. We're seeing it in Central Europe. We're seeing it all across the world. And so that is absolutely a problem. But I don't think we should therefore connect that together and think, oh, well, actually what we're seeing is Putin in charge of anything.
What we just saw with Greece, though, in the first barely a week or days after this government actually formally took power, we saw them basically scuttle the EU consensus on sanctions. I mean, it was pretty much expected that there would be new sanctions. Additional sanctions. People were talking about a SWIFT ban, even, which I believe the Americans want. You started hearing more and more about it from the Europeans. But now the only thing they can get the Greeks on board for was just continuing the current sanctions till September. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, that's not making them tremble in the Kremlin. Put it that way. So we're already seeing the practical implications of this. And if we see something like this replicated in Spain, for example, I saw a poll yesterday. I believe Marie Le Pen's party is in the National Front is in first place in France, right? Or she is in first place in France. We could start to see this. When we start to see this in the bigger frontline European states, then can't this get a little dangerous?
Absolutely. I mean, what happened in Greece was not so much pro-Putin as anti-Merkel. But clearly, it works to Putin's advantage. Absolutely, this is a real challenge, because this is a time, after all, of troubles in particularly the European alliance. And it's not just economic. I think, the economics has simply sharpened a whole series of other political and, for want of a better word, ideological divisions about quite where Europe is going, quite whether or not the federal engine is revving too fast, and even if I think of the UK and the rise of UKIP, there are lots of these opportunities which the Kremlin will eagerly, gleefully grab. And yes, that could lead to a real fragmentation. And this is where I would, in a way, all I can do is hope that Putin's Bolshevik, and in this respect, it's always a dangerous word to start throwing around, but in this respect, it is fascist in the true original Italian fascist sense of the word. This notion that precisely that it is actually, when it comes down to it, will that wins. He might, God forbid, be proven right in that respect. But on the other hand, it's incredibly dangerous. He's leveraging what is still a really rather weak and brittle country.
Yes.
How far do you, as it were, win the war for Europe but at the cost of losing the battle for Russia.
Well, this is what I wonder, when we're going to hit that point, because, I mean, as I, you know, you look at the ruble falling, you look at what's happening to the Russian economy, and you have to ask yourself, how are they not backing off? I mean, how far can they continue to go until the chickens come home to roost, so to speak? I don't know, and this is I don't have an answer to that, but it's fascinating, frightening, and disturbing to watch. I wanted to go back to the deep state and the ruling cabal thing before we moved on to the second part. But in terms of the long-term stability of the two ruling models, in terms of the distribution of benefits, because I think these two things are related. In the deep state, of course, benefits are broadly distributed, along with inputs. In a ruling cabal, you get the sense that both the benefits and the inputs certainly, and the benefits are held among a much narrower circle of people who control the resources as well as the decision-making levers. So with those two things in mind, how stable is this model compared to the old deep state model?
I think it carries with it the capacity to be much, much less stable, but particularly because the fact that they're moving from a deep state model.
Mm-hmm.
Now, had this been, you know, this much more sort of tightly autocratic model been what emerged in 2000 out of the chaos of Yeltsinism,
mm-hmm.
then one could think, well, in that respect, it would have been the sort of the Central Asian model, really. But the point is, you've had an extended period of the deep state with its breadth, precisely, of benefits, its breadth of inputs, now suddenly shrinking. So in other words, what you've got is a lot of people who have got used to benefits, got used to being, in some respect or another, insiders. Yes, they're not getting as much as a Sechin or a Yakunin, but they're doing pretty well. And all of a sudden, they're now finding that as the cake shrinks and as the sort of decision-making power gets more and more concentrated, they're probably being left out. And so I think this is where the real instability lies. But the other thing is, I mean, a small oligarchic cabal can actually apportion resources quite effectively. They can, if they're smart, see, you know, who needs what and buy people off. But that requires two things. One is obviously the resources being available, and that's clearly a problem. I mean, Russia is not on its knees economically yet, but, you know, it's definitely crouching. Exactly. It's heading down there. The second thing is it needs a clear sense within the cabal that they need to distribute resources more broadly and to know who to distribute them to. And that, again, I think is the problem, because actually what we tend to see is that the people in charge tend to be really quite selfish.
Mm-hmm.
That they are very much about providing all the resources they can to their friends and their closest allies, and the rest, devil for them. Unless we actually see a shift in that priority. I mean, it's interesting, you know, recently sort of the confirmation that it's a Rothenburg company that's going to be building the Kerch
right.
Bridge. You know, again, one of the plum forthcoming prestige projects, and it goes to a usual suspect. Well, I mean, if they want to continue to play that game, that's fine, but they're going to leave a lot of angry people in their wake.
Yeah. No, one of the things that came out of the Bloomberg piece last week about that actually gave me the idea to eventually do this podcast about the shrinking inner circle was that a broad section of the elite is actually very, very angry and disturbed right now, and they have no avenue to vent it. They're afraid to complain, basically. You have to wonder when that fear is gonna melt away at some point, and then what the implications of that are gonna be. There's one more thing I wanted to touch with you, Mark, because I know you love talking about Sergei Shoigu. A lot of the accounts of who is in the inner sanctum right now, in the handful, and again, we don't know, but there's a lot of guesswork here. A lot of it, the usual suspect. It's Patrushev, it's Ivanov, but Shoigu's name comes up in a lot of these. And I have to wonder, because I never lumped Shoigu in with the rest of these guys. I don't consider him a hardliner. I mean, in fact, we've considered him a lot of times a technocrat and a potential pragmatic alternative within the elite on this podcast. What do you make of that, of Shoigu? Because I do believe Shoigu is in. I mean, he's the defense minister, after all. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, you say, oh, well, he's a defense minister after all. But on the other hand, no one talks about Lavrov.
Right.
I mean, and he's the foreign minister. So you'd think if titles mattered, then you'd think Lavrov would be there too. Mm. No, I mean, I think Shoigu, it's an interesting case. Yeah, and I sort of see his name cropping up. I think that the thing about Shoigu is, I mean, obviously, there is a clear role for conversations with the defense minister at a time like this, when you're fighting essentially a war. And therefore, I'm not surprised that he's often around Putin. But no, I see no evidence that Shoigu is playing a decision-making role. I think the thing is that he is, I mean, one of the things he's very clearly good at is being a non-threatening and efficient manager. Minister. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think you might say he comes into the circles to do briefings and such like. I'm not convinced that he stays necessarily in the room when they decide policy.
So that doesn't put him in the inner circle. So anybody that's saying he's in it is. So you don't think he's in on the in. Who do you think is on the in now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that.
What names would you throw out there? I mean, I tossed out a few.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, you know, I think we're seeing, you know, Ivanov, Patrushev, Botnikov, definitely. Yep. Yakunin,
yep.
Absolutely. I think Sechin as well.
I'm not sure about Sechin anymore, to be honest. I mean, I'm not sure.
It's harder to be sure, but
he's become more of a businessman than a Silovik, put it that way.
Ah, but this is the interesting thing. I think, actually, if we're looking at the division within this very, very small inner circle, the idea of, I mean, you said Siloviki and ideologues. Well, I would in some ways actually divide them between executives and entrepreneurs of power. Because if you have people like Ivanov, Patrushev, and Bortnikov, I mean, obviously they live decent lives as members of the inner sort of Russian elite. But on the other hand, there's no real signs that they're busy trying to amass personal wealth. They're about power. Mm. They're about policy. And then you've got the Yakunins and the Sechins.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly the other, you know, in the other sort of oligarchs who are currently on the in, like the Rotenbergs, like Timchenko, who clearly have some kind of input into policy and are all about the money.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think that's actually the crucial distinction. It's the policy people first and foremost and the money people first and foremost. And obviously, the money people can well be, I mean, you look at someone like Yakunin, he's also an ideologue in his own way. But the point is, I think that, you know, when it really comes down to it, he's about the distribution of resources in the right direction.
Last thing on Shoigu, do you think he's down with this? I mean, do you think he? I mean, what? You've watched the man for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, but he is a very, very inscrutable individual. All I can really say, and
I've always had a soft spot for the man, and I always thought he was one of the people that could potentially emerge as a good positive figure there.
Unless he is actually much, much dumber than we have thought, which I don't actually believe. He has to be reading the reports, even the reports that aren't actually passing through the filters of the presidential administration to Putin's desk. And I think he must know that the arithmetic is not really on Russia's side, and especially the long-term arithmetic. But I think he also knows full well that if he spoke up, he would not change policy, he would change jobs.
Mm-hmm. On that note, we'll shift gears to the second part. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at the odd behavior of the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, and what it may mean for his relations with Russia. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Как они говорят, сейчас русского мира чуть ли не России.
Говорят, что там Крым когда-то неправильно отошел к Украине. Исконно там российское, и тогда монголо-татарского ига.
С Россией надо было работать и требовать с них, чтобы...
Союз Беларуси и России, это...
Они нам тоже платили в твердой валюте, в долларах или в евро.
Ну что, возвращаться к тому, что было? Перекраивать границы нельзя.
Always makes me smile to listen to Lukashenko talk. It's something about his intonation. I don't know. I have a soft spot for the way he speaks the Russian language. Well, like I said on the Daily Vertical on Thursday, Belarus is very much on my mind lately, and it's more on my mind after watching Lukashenko's presser yesterday. I mean, Alexander Lukashenko's been acting, like I said, quite strangely for him lately. He's slammed...
She's quite a high bar.
Which is a very high bar. he slammed the annexation of Crimea, likening it to Mongolia seizing large parts of Russia. He's purged the many pro-Moscow elements from his bureaucracy. He's promoting the Belarusian language. Suddenly he's the champion of the Belarusian language. He's seeking to de-Russify Belarusian schools, which has led some in Moscow to calling him a fascist. Apparently, for them, a fascist is anybody in a former Soviet republic that would like to speak their own language. He's cozying up to Brussels. Now, Lukashenko's played this game before. It's usually a little ploy to squeeze more subsidies out of Moscow. And as soon as he gets those subsidies out of Moscow, he becomes obedient again. And Moscow's usually obliged him, mainly because the costs and the risks of removing him outweigh the benefits. But that, I think, I may be wrong, but I think that's all changed. I mean, the Ukraine crisis seems to have really, really spooked Lukashenko. And he really does appear to want to distance himself from Russia. And there are some indications that Russia might not be shy about taking him down this time around, maybe. The Russian media is getting much more critical of him. And the influential Russian Institute for Strategic Research, the Kremlin think tank that urged the intervention in Ukraine, is now calling for his ouster. Mark, what do you think we're looking at here? Another crisis on the horizon or a lot of bluff?
I think in some ways what's happening is that Lukashenko is trying to forestall another crisis on the horizon by precisely building his position, his strengths, making himself look a more indigestible target. I think it was fascinating that you also had in Belarus the passing of a law explicitly
yes.
directed towards the little green men,
yep.
saying that this will be considered to be an act of war.
Yep.
Now, it's hard to believe that even Lukashenko, I don't think he's going to believe that somehow Lithuanian special forces are going to be starting
right.
sort of strolling across his border or similar.
The law was couched right. any foreign. It didn't explicitly single out Russia or even
no,
little
exactly,
green
but
men.
The point
but,
is, but
it was
know,
the little green
we
men.
Know,
we know what
we
it
know
was.
Who
Just
it,
like
it
in his press conference
it.
Yesterday, he said, "Well, we will not be dominated by Russia or the West."
Yeah.
It was. He was very careful how he couched it. Go ahead.
But the very fact of actually in inserting Russia. I mean, we've got to realize. I mean, Lukashenko. I mean, at times he was talking about unity with Russia. There is a massive military interpenetration of Belarus and Russia. I mean, for example, if Belarus went independent, let's say, you actually have a hole kicked out of Russia's air defense zone. Because at the moment, Russia's air defense systems are in Belarus.
Right.
So to actually be even mentioning Russia in the context of a potential aggressor is a huge sea change. That's what's significant, rather than just the fact he also mentions the West. And you know, in successive speeches of late, he has, even by saying, you know, we wouldn't want this to happen or we don't expect this to happen, but the very fact that he keeps raising the possibility of Russian aggression, possibility of having to fight Russia, even if, you know, God forbid, we even, you know, even Russia. Well, the very fact that you're mentioning it says a hell
yeah,
of a lot.
No, I know. It's...
And I think this is it. We see, from Lukashenko's point of view, in a way he has two equally unpalatable and equally potentially dangerous threats. One is, again, if one looks at Ukraine, the prospect of some kind of, you know,
ouster
by sort of popularizing or whatever. Well, that's what the KGB is there for. That's what the other apparatuses of the state are there for. One of the reasons why the Maidan was so successful was that Yanukovych was so unused to the notion of using violence and did not use his existing apparatus effectively. Right. I think Lukashenko would have fewer qualms.
He's got plenty of experience with that, yeah.
Exactly. But the second thing is precisely that we now see, as a result of that, a much more interventionist Russia. And that is clearly his concern. And it's not necessarily that I think he believes that Russia is about to try and do something of this nature. I think he's just trying to sort of basically warn Moscow off.
But can he precipitate what he's trying to warn off by doing this? I mean, Risi did call for his ouster, yeah. And Risi was instrumental in kind of framing the Ukraine debate within the elite.
I still think that Lukashenko is more responding to rather than precipitating. Mm. The very fact that the Russian media, as you said, has of late become increasingly critical of Belarus, that doesn't just happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know, particularly when it comes to the TV media, you know, these things happen because someone has made a decision. Now, that doesn't mean a decision that is part of a sort of a complex and inexorable drive towards intervention of some kind. But it certainly indicates that the government is increasingly unhappy with Lukashenko. And even in silly little things like the way that Belarus is being used as a turntable for smuggling sanctioned goods into the country and so forth. I mean, I think there are all kind of reasons why they've long been irritated by Lukashenko, but those irritations have crystallized into something rather more powerful now. And I think this is why Lukashenko is basically making the case that, you know, if we're putting it in other terms, what he's saying to Moscow is, if you want me, by God, you're going to have to fight for it.
Mm. Now, let's look at this from the West, the point of view of the West. Now, like our Brussels correspondent, our excellent Brussels correspondent, Richard Joswiak, got us some material this week about how the EU is like happy to play with this because they want they have designs on Belarus. Nobody's going to go that far, but they're happy to irritate Moscow at this point. But if you look at this from the West, right? Now, Lukashenko wants to come to the Eastern Partnership Summit. Now, he's on a visa ban list. You got to wonder, it's going to be interesting to watch if he's going to be at the Eastern Partnership Summit. Is it possible that Lukashenko could turn out to be, you know, a son of a bitch, but our son of a bitch? I mean, by that, I mean, would the West be willing to overlook the human rights for the geopolitical gains? And could, even if they were willing to do that, would they be able to reel that one in?
Multiple questions there. Let's just start with the shoulds. On one level, I confess, it gives me distinct qualms to think about the West cozying up to Lukashenko.
Yes.
But on the other hand, given that we've just seen Western leaders in sort of pitiably fawning mode in Saudi Arabia, I mean, it is clear that human rights are not the absolute lodestone to which we steer our policy.
We make exceptions, for petrol.
Exactly. You know, Lukashenko's got no oil, but on the other hand, he now has another potential asset that he's going to try and leverage. So I can absolutely see the value of trying this. The problem is, in the West, especially, it has to be said, in Europe, we tend to be really rather clumsy about actually how we handle this kind of an approach. If we're going to do it, then we have to do it properly. I think it is possible for the West to precisely not make Lukashenko our friend.
But our son of a bitch. Alone, I said our son of a bitch.
Exactly. I think, you know, but find a way of helping Lukashenko detach himself from Russia. And actually, in the process, doing something which will, you know, potentially give the West more leverage for the, in the future, democracy and transparent sort of governance measures and all that kind of thing, you know, help build that. But if we're going to build Lukashenko into our policies, we have to accept what we're doing. And that means that we're also going to have to not give in to the temptation of, at the same time, feel that we need to lecture him about corruption and human rights. Mm. Any more than we do, frankly, the Saudis or various other less savory allies, whatever. That, for me, I think is the big dilemma. And I'm not convinced the West can do that. I'm not convinced the West should do that, but that's a separate issue. But even if the West would make that decision, I think the temptation to also feel the need to layer in condemnation of human rights abuses and so forth in a way that actually would not only alienate Lukashenko, but also push him back towards Russia, I think there. It's a very, very dangerous game. I think actually the best thing is rather than actively try and win over Lukashenko, tempting though that seems in the short term, is just rely on the fact that at the moment the natural gravity is pushing Lukashenko away from Russia. This regime in Moscow is itself a much more cack-handed, clumsy, authoritarian one. It's one that actually sees much less scope for semi-autonomous allies, which is what Lukashenko at best always was.
Right.
Putin is pushing Lukashenko away. Let Putin do that, rather than let Brussels start to try and attract Lukashenko, because as I said, I think it wouldn't be able to do it.
This seems to be, from what we're hearing from Brussels, this seems to be exactly what Brussels is doing. They're very happy to play along right now, but they're not pushing too hard. But they're seeing, you know, they're happy to irritate Moscow a little bit. You have to wonder if the West really made a play for Belarus. I mean, Moscow would fight like an alley cat for that. I mean, we'd be talking an outright invasion, I would imagine, because, like you said, their air defense systems are located in Belarus, and they're not going to give that up.
I think this is, I mean, that actually is the sort of thing which would make Moscow far, far more tempted to contemplate, not an invasion ideally, but precisely some kind of managed and induced regime change. Which, again, if one was going to adopt a truly Machiavellian approach, the West should encourage. The more that Moscow finds itself overextending, the more that Moscow finds itself intervening and becoming a more and more dangerous neighbor to have. Because let's be honest, one wonders if, let's say, Moscow also intervened in Belarus. And let's say it was a successful, neat takeover of power, the installation of some different Belarusian. Well, one wonders how that would look from, say, Kazakhstan's perspective. Mm-hmm. I think one would see that actually would worry a lot of people. So a truly Machiavellian approach would be to do everything possible to basically encourage Russia to intervene. Mm-hmm. I personally would not want to see that happen. But the point is that we're at that situation where really Brussels, Washington, the West as a whole needs to do one thing or the other.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to just sit back, fine, you know, not do anything to discourage this process and allow its natural dynamics to take place,
mm-hmm.
or go all in and decide that really the aim is regime change in Moscow,
right.
Which is what clearly some believe, but no one really is willing to articulate it as a policy. It's what's in between that is the most dangerous and most messy. Mm.
Yeah, no, I think and where we are is somewhere in between right now. Another, speaking of Russia and its neighbors, I mean, we haven't even brought this up yet, but Armenia with the Russian soldier killing the Armenian family, this has probably done more to damage Russian-Armenian relations than anything that's happened since the Soviet breakup. Now, we're talking about now, you know, two countries that are supposedly, you know, members of the customs union and the founding members of the Eurasian Union. You have to wonder if this project isn't completely in tatters right now.
Well, a key element of the whole Eurasian Economic Union was Russia's economic strength.
Mm-hmm.
That actually people wanted to be part of it because they wanted to be connected to the Russian market. Well, that's not really quite such a draw these days. The second element is precisely that Putin seemed to be standing as, because of his line as being the sort of defender of a sovereign Russia, but likewise there was a sense that he was willing to protect the sovereignty of others. That the element, sovereignty of others compared with everyone other than Russia, he was talking to regimes, often quite nasty regimes, and saying, look, we don't care how nasty you are. As long as you're part of our gang, we will protect you. Well, particularly as you now see the whole Moscow-Minsk relationship worsening, the sense of Moscow as being a reliable protector is also increasingly hard to accept.
Mm.
And if we look at the Armenian case, I mean, again, dramatically mismanaged. Moscow should have been immediately and gratuitously apologetic.
They did handle it at a very high level and appeared to take it very seriously. I think they understood the gravity of the situation.
But
Shoigu sent his deputy there immediately. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's fine. I mean, but it's a question of, I mean, yes, they said this is very serious and he sent a deputy and so forth. Yeah, we had faces. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem to be that they managed how actually the Armenians regarded and feel about this particularly effectively. There's more to responses than just simply ensuring that the right guy in a grey suit turns up.
Right.
And I think the sense that Russian forces are somehow these malign bandits in uniform, which, let's face it, is a fairly broadly held view within a lot of non-Russian neighboring states, right, was very much reinforced by this.
Yeah. All right. Well, as we're almost ready to wrap up here, Mark, anything you want to add before we call it a day?
In some ways, I think it's interesting that one can link these two halves together, in that how Moscow has handled Belarus, in some ways, is a metaphor for the wider issues of this new model state. That for a long time, Russia handled a very, very difficult neighbor, Lukashenko, surprisingly well, holding him at arm's length when he was pushing, but when he seemed less interested, knowing how to reel him back in. And as a result, they got what they wanted out of their Belarusian relationship. Everything from joint military operations and an air defense zone through to a kind of, shall we say, a deniable turntable country for a variety of grey exports and such like. So from their point of view, actually, I would say that the Belarus policy was a success. Now that seems to be being mishandled, and in part, I think the reason is precisely because the people who matter at the moment in decision-making don't really care about Belarus, don't really understand Belarus, and aren't really interested in talking to the people who understand Belarus. So in some ways, this is a classic example. It's not a deal-breaker. It's not a crucial issue at this stage. But it's one more of these policy problems that are going to crop up because you have a small circle making decisions that they don't fully understand.
I love it when we can always pull things around full circle, and that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for an interesting discussion, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
And I'd always also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.